This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents Beyond Exile, written by J.L. Bourne, narrated by Jay Snyder.
Aftermath. 23 May. 0157 hours. I started feeling physically better the day of the 21st. The attack from the raiders had really busted me up. I got out of bed, drank a gallon of water over the course of a few hours, and stretched a bit. I asked John what it looked like topside. He didn't want to say much of anything, so I followed him up to the control room to look for myself. The previous night, John had rushed out in the darkness and pulled the bag off one of the cameras and dashed back inside. There were undead about, and he didn't wish to be out for long amongst them. More undead inhabit the area around where the fence was damaged. They are like water, flowing to the point of least resistance. My painful burns are healing, but they were not that awful to begin with. Just a few blisters on my face and other places. Our victory in the last encounter with the insurgents was largely due to chance. What if they hadn't been convoying cross-country with a fuel truck? We would have probably been executed, unable to overcome their numbers. Outnumbered not only by the undead, but by those who wished us dead. I feared the insurgents nearly as much as the creatures. In theory, they could at least out-strategize us by putting their heads together and brainstorming on ways to force us from this compound. We do not know how many tangos remain. However, I am sure they still dwarf our numbers. On camera number 3, I could see the charred bodies of men walking about the wreckage of the diesel truck and trailer. Men that I had killed. That night, we went outside and put them down. To avoid muzzle flash, I snuck up on them from behind in the darkness with NVGs, selected single fire on my carbine, and popped them in the back of the head with the barrel almost touching the skull. After every depression of the trigger, I saw them react to the noise and start moving toward the sound, blind in the darkness. They could still hear, even though many of them had nothing that resembled ears. I repeated this 17 times before they were all laid to rest. We noticed that 3 vehicles had not been harmed badly in the fuel blast from the other night. There was a Land Rover, a Jeep, and a late model Ford Bronco 100 yards from the charred grass zone. John and I approached with caution. Upon closer inspection, I discovered that both of the Jeep's front tires were blown, and the window glass was spiderwebbed and concave. 50 meters farther were the Land Rover and the Ford. As I approached the Land Rover, I noticed that it appeared to be in very good condition and had no previous owners inhabiting the interior. Bonus. John and I walked up to the door. I opened it and checked the interior more closely. It smelled like pine, probably from the tree hanging on the rearview mirror. We got in and carefully shut the doors just enough for the latch to catch. I reached down to the ignition and turned. It roared to life. I suppose I would leave the keys in it, too, in a world like this. I looked down at the flimsy plastic tag on the key. It read, Nelms Land Rover of Texas. I suppose the Marauders had acquired this vehicle after everything collapsed. The gas tank was 3/4 of the way full, and it had 3,000 miles on the odometer. Not even broken in. I put the vehicle in gear and sped off back toward the perimeter fence of the compound. When we neared the raider-covered cameras, we got out and took turns pulling the bags off them while the other covered. The hole in the fence was about the same size as the length of the Land Rover. I didn't feel like doing any fence repair tonight, so I brushed up on my parallel parking skills and maneuvered her in front of the fence gap to discourage any of our cold-blooded amigos from getting inside the perimeter. John climbed out the passenger side. I climbed over the console and also climbed out the passenger side. I hit the lock on the door and slammed it shut, putting the key in my pocket. Who's I kidding? I'm still not leaving the keys in it. 12:48 hours. I woke up a couple of hours ago after another painful, sleepless night. My blisters are starting to pop, causing some respectable pain. I have a few blisters around my eyes where my skin was unprotected by my Nomex gear. The lump on the back of my head is starting to shrink, and more recently, I am noticeably sorer than I was right after my little incident with the tanker. This is a good sign. I am healing. I have given up on the internet. It is down for the count. The websites that I had been checking to test things out are down, i.e., military bases in the four corners of the United States. No internet activity. It is probably safe to assume that if anyone is out there to log on to the net, it won't matter. The backbone is shot, and it looks like all the IT guys are out to lunch for the next 100 years. The Land Rover has GPS navigation. I went out to check things over, and it appears the GPS is only acquiring 3 satellites for purposes of position finding. I don't know how long those satellites will remain in orbit without ground control station support, as well as the birds we are using to take photographs. We are fast approaching the Iron Age. I keep fighting off the mental urge of self-destructive behavior. I don't mean this in a wrist-slitting way. I suppose I'm just feeling the need to take more risks because I'm tired of being in this predicament. But so is everyone else. So I remain. Heading out in a bit with John to attempt to quietly repair the down fence. 24 May. 23:44 hours. John and I repaired the fence with the scrap metal and parts left over from the debris from the raider attack. We also retrieved the Ford Bronco. It had 4 full gas cans in the back. I filled the Land Rover up with 1 of the gas cans in the event we would be using it in the future. I don't know why I didn't think of this before, but I had totally forgotten about the aircraft throughout all of this. I remembered just as John was pulling up in the Bronco. John and I went to the tree line to see if it had been tampered with or possibly damaged by stray fire. It was just as I left it. The foliage I had placed on the plane to hide it was withered and brown, making it stand out a little. John and I gathered more branches, improving the overall camouflage of the aircraft before we left it to its solitude. The undead in this area have been scattered. The marauders neutralized many of them as they herded them back and forth around the compound. The cameras only show a few stragglers at the front blast door. The rock-bearing freak is still shambling about there, and has been for over a month. It is banging on the blast door, marching to the beat of its own drum. The empty missile silo is a mess. John and I don't even want to bother with it. I don't know what is causing these things to get up and walk around after death, and I don't wish to be shuffling around down there and accidentally cut myself on an infected jawbone. If I had a cement truck, I would fill up the fucking hole and just forget about it. 28 May. 18:51 hours. We are still alive, but our scenario echoes of those that were in the hospital on life support before all of this happened. They were living on borrowed time, doomed to die. We are one and the same. Eventually, the averages will catch me. It's the when that is the real clincher. I wouldn't mind getting my hands on another fuel tanker and not blowing it up, so that we would have fuel for any expeditions we may need to undertake. I could park at a safe distance from the compound, learning from the raider's mistake. It would definitely be worth the risk to have an overabundant source of gasoline. I am not sure how much those tankers hold. However, I am sure one of them would supply enough fuel for our 2 vehicles here for an extended period. Finding one should not be that difficult, as we could cherry-pick one from the interstate up north a few miles. 21:05 hours. More code language on the radios, This time they are switching the frequency every minute to what I assume is a planned order. Good ComSec. 31 May. 01, 18 hours. I cannot sleep. Tara and I talked for a few hours today. I feel like I have no more purpose, and I'm not alone in this. Many of us miss normal. We miss when punching a clock and doing a job was boring. At least before all of this happened, I had a job and goals. My only goal now is to stay alive. The adults got together today in the recreation room and drank some rum and had a good old time. I almost forgot about our situation in my alcohol-induced euphoria. I needed the release. We had been eating the compound's packaged meals since our arrival here. I would like some variety in my diet, but shopping is getting more dangerous by the day. It has been Memorial Day for an hour and a half. Tara and I went outside yesterday to pick some wild Texas flowers as sort of a memorial to everyone we have lost. I personally don't think there are enough flowers in the world. It pains me to no end to think of my mother and father walking the hills of our land like those creatures. I'm almost tempted to go home, just to see for myself, and put them to rest like a decent son should. Laura's schooling is coming along. Jan asked me to teach Laura some world history since I enjoyed it in my former life as an officer. Laura's eyes grew wide when I told her the stories of how the United States came about and how men walked on the moon and such. She has never known a world without smartphones, HDTV, or the Internet, and she's far too young to have ever seen Schoolhouse Rock. I'd give just about anything to be sitting in my living room on an early 1980s Saturday morning singing about being just a bill sitting on Capitol Hill. I feel a bit of guilt that she has no peers and that there is no little boy to pull her pigtails in school. I really need my sleep, as John and I have a little trip planned in the aircraft tomorrow. We are going out to find some fuel for the plane and do some reconnaissance. This time, we won't be flying so low as to invite small arms fire. I have my charts from our trip to Matagorda Island that cover this area's airports. I would also like to find some sort of synthetic camouflage netting to better disguise the aircraft. Hobby. 01, June. 01, 40 hours. John, William, and I took off early yesterday morning toward the west. We snuck out to the aircraft just before the sun came up on the eastern horizon. We pushed it to the grassy strip where we would take off. In the distance, we could see some shambling stragglers moving about. It wasn't long before we were airborne. It was a last-minute decision to take Will. He insisted that he go. We were able to establish a communications link with Hotel 23 via the VHF radio on the Cessna. If the girls were going to get into any trouble, we would be able to communicate with them. We were looking for a large airport outside a major urban center. Before forcing myself to go to sleep last night, I picked out William P. Hobby Airport. It was just south of Houston, outside the center of the city. It was not a long flight. En route, we flew over numerous small towns, all with the same speckles of walking dead dominating the streets below. It wasn't 45 minutes, and already we were in sight of Hobby Airport. I thought it safe to lower my altitude, as I would be able to see any living human figures below trying to shoot at me from the open concrete. Approaching the large expanse of paved runway and taxi area, I saw yet another symbol of death. A Boeing 737 was on the tarmac, with severe fuselage wrinkles indicating a hard crashed landing. It was the only large plane in the airport. There were other, smaller aircraft, executive jets and smaller props similar to the Cessna, but this was the last of the large passenger jets here at Hobby. We circled around once more to make sure we had the proper assessment before we landed. I could see a fuel truck in the distance near one of the aircraft hangars. The hangar was large compared to the others, and was most likely for Boeing aircraft, just like the one that is forever disabled on the runway. Our curiosity propelled us, and we decided to land the plane near the large aircraft to see if anything of value might be inside. One advantage to this was that it was out in the open and not adjacent to any buildings that would leave us an easy mark for someone or something to sneak up on us. William would stay outside near the aircraft to keep watch, as we found an entry point. All of the window shades were down on the 737. It wouldn't really matter since the windows were nearly 15 feet off the ground anyway. The over-wing escape hatches were secure, and we were not successful in getting them open as the fuselage ripple stresses had jammed them tight. That left the co-pilot's escape hatch on the starboard side of the cockpit glass. I looked up, 10 feet into the air on the right side of the cockpit, and saw how we were going to gain entrance to this aircraft. Using a grapple that Will and I had previously constructed from the rope and some metal left over from last month's tanker explosion, I was able to climb up to the window. First, I supported John's weight on my shoulders as he reached up to open the emergency access latch, releasing the airtight seal to the cockpit. I almost dropped John when he carelessly fumbled the unattached piece of cockpit glass to the floor inside the plane. I cursed when I finally realized what he had done. I grunted under his weight on my shoulders and asked him if he had heard any reactions to our noise from the interior of the aircraft. He replied no, but also said that the smell coming from inside was beyond terrible and that the cockpit access door was closed. Using the pitot tubes jutting from the aluminum skin of the aircraft, John climbed back down off my shoulders and we made a decision. This was enough for me. I wasn't going to risk my ass trying to squeeze through the tight emergency opening, only to get it bitten off as I tried to regain my balance on the inside. This aircraft was a tomb, and it was going to stay that way. I can only dream of the horrors that are waiting inside. Buckled passengers writhing to be set free from their belts, dead flight attendants carefully walking the aisles, still performing their duties, even in the afterlife. We returned to the aircraft to continue formulating our plan for getting the fuel and any other supplies we deemed necessary. The hangar was our goal. I doubted we were going to be able to move the fuel truck to where the aircraft rested, so we all climbed back in, and I started her up and taxied toward the hangar and the fuel supply. The closer we got, the more we knew the value of ground truth intelligence. We could see movement inside the airport through the aircraft windows. Dead. All of them. I gave them no more thought when I saw the horror spilling out of the open hangar that we were quickly closing on. I stopped the aircraft and left the engine running as I jumped out, rifle in hand. John was out quick, and Will followed, spilling out on my side. He started to walk past me when I reached my hand out, the way my mother used to reach out across my chest when our car was about to make a quick stop. He was fixated on the creatures and nearly walked himself into our aircraft's spinning propeller blades. We fell back and began our task of killing them. There were roughly 20 that I could see. I could see shadows of movement dancing underneath the belly of the fuel truck. I screamed out over the engine for the men to kill the ones approaching the propeller first to avoid any aircraft damage. We needed the fuel, and we needed to keep the engine running until we were safe from them. It was a catch-22. I began firing, and they followed suit. I killed 5 before number 6 refused to go down. 2 shots to the head, and it still came at me. I gave up on the head and shot its legs out from under it. John and Will were making short work of the others as I picked off the remaining undead behind the fuel truck. We were clear for now. I checked the fuel truck to see if it was in working order. Using the butt of my rifle, I struck the tank. The sound that resonated indicated that there was fuel inside. One thing seemed odd. Why would a small prop aircraft fuel truck be parked in front of the Boeing hangar? I now began to think that I was not the only pilot that had visited this airfield since things went crazy. I wondered if this truck had been used recently, reused, or if I was just overthinking. I climbed up to the driver's window and peered in before I opened it up. Nothing. Keys were inside, and it appeared to be in decent condition. I turned over the ignition, and it coughed to life on the first attempt. Either someone had been maintaining this vehicle, or I was just especially lucky with the battery charge. I flipped the switches for the pumps and got out. Before shutting down the aircraft, I checked our perimeter to make sure we weren't about to be blitzed. As the prop spun down and the engine noise abated, the unnerving clicking sound of jewelry hitting the terminal glass a couple hundred yards away filled my ears and grabbed my attention. The undead almost seemed to protest our taking of the fuel. They could see us from the inside, and they were thrashing the glass in protest. Watches, rings, and bracelets sounded like loud rain on the tempered glass, even from this distance. I unplugged the fuel caps and walked over to the truck. When I opened the control box to flip the switch, a yellow piece of folded, legal-sized paper fell out and started to drift downwind. I ran after the paper, caught it with my boot, and unfolded it to read, Davis Family, Lake Charles Airfield, Louisiana, 514. It was a family. Survivors. It was brilliant of them to leave this note inside the exterior fuel pump control switch box. Davis had shown himself to be an intellectual with this single gesture. He didn't overtly spray paint the runway with his name and location. He left it in a place where another pilot could find it. Aircraft fuel is useless to automobiles, rendering an aircraft fuel truck the same. I took the note and put it in my pocket. Walking up to the aircraft, I could tell John and Will were edgy. I filled the aircraft tanks to the top as I watched them. Will's skin seemed to be getting lighter in color in anticipation of what I was going to say next. Time to check out the hangar. I don't know why they were afraid. The hangar doors were wide open, and anything that wanted us could just walk out here and try. After all the gunfire, I was nearly certain that there were no more of those things inside this hangar. I was right. As the three of us broke the threshold of the large rolling hangar doorway, I almost pissed my pants. Something swooped in out of the darkness and nearly hit me in the head. It seems that a family of swallows had a summer nest just above the entryway, and the mother didn't like me near her young. I could hear them chirping above. Makes me wonder how many undead eyes she had poked out in the previous weeks. I steered clear of the nest and made my way back to the supplies. The hangar had numerous plexiglass skylight openings. It was a nice sunny day. The smell of death was in the air, but the smell of rot had followed the undead outside the hangar to their demise at the hands of our small team. It wasn't long before we found the door to the large supply room. Slowly, I opened the door with a long pole commonly used to clean out-of-reach aircraft windows. Nothing but the smell of mothballs rolled out to meet us. This room was clean. I was acclimated to the smell of the undead, but I could surely tell when their smell was absent. The supply room could almost have been considered a mini warehouse. The shelves were lined with superfluous aircraft parts and equipment. This was the Boeing supply and maintenance hangar. However, I wasn't looking for jet engine parts. I was looking for survival radios and equipment. It was then that I came upon something that I couldn't leave home without. There were rows of black briefcase-looking devices labeled Inmarsat. We had stumbled upon aviation portable satellite telephones. I had no idea if they were still operational. However, four of them on the right side of the shelf were still sealed in plastic. We took those four and moved them to the door. Continuing our loop around the supply locker, we found numerous portable distress radios, inflatable life rafts, and other things of that nature. We took the satellite phones and portable VHF maintenance radios and made our exit. We were full on fuel, had four new satellite phones, some portable VHF radios, and had also made a startling discovery, that a family had headed out to an airstrip in Louisiana weeks ago. It was time to leave. We all loaded up the aircraft and began our journey home. This time, I stayed above 7,000 feet until I was almost on top of Hotel 23. I didn't want to take the chance of any stray weapons fire shooting me down. As I approached the compound, I called out over the radio to Jan and Tara, telling them, "Navy 1 is 3 down and locked for a full stop." I mused at the use of the presidential call sign, but no one got it. I bet Davis would get it. We landed and hid the aircraft once again. I entered the complex, thinking of the Davis family, and wondered if they ever made it to that airfield. Tower of Charles. 04 June, 22:21 hours. I have been arguing with our group over the past 3 days about whether I should attempt to find the Davis family at Lake Charles. I have checked my charts, and it is not that far. Of course, if this becomes a reality, I will calculate the exact distance and fuel required to make the journey. The others seem to think that the risk far outweighs the benefit of finding them. John is neutral, but Jan, Tara, and Will are adamant that this could swiftly develop into a suicide mission. We were able to charge up the satellite phones, but unfortunately, as previously determined, there is no one to call with them. They seem to work fine, though, when we use them to dial up the other phones. It didn't take long to figure them out. I just don't know how the billing works. I know the phones belong to the airlines, and I know that no one is left to send a bill for the satellite usage. I am just worried that there may be some sort of automated system shutoff when the phones reach a certain number of minutes. I wonder what they are doing at Lake Charles Airfield right now. I wonder if they even knew their note would be found. I feel the need to establish communications with them, even if it means just dropping one of the satellite phones out of the aircraft door with a makeshift parachute. At least it would be something. We could communicate with them, get more information, more ideas. 08 June. 02, 26 hours. I am leaving this morning. John and the others are staying behind in the event I bring someone back. I don't want to terribly overstress the aircraft. I hope they have stayed near the airfield at Lake Charles. As I sit here and stare at the yellow piece of paper that is almost a month old, I wonder if they still live, or if they were taken under siege, as John and I that day at the tower. William almost begged to come with me, but as I mentioned before, I may be bringing back survivors. I have no way of knowing, so I cannot take the chance on extra aircraft weight. I am bringing 2 fully charged satellite phones and my usual loadout of 1 pistol with 59mm rounds and carbine with a few hundred rounds. A couple days of food and water will also make its home in the avionics bay of the aircraft. In this journal, I thought I would write something pithy and creative in the event they would be my last written words. Since I am neither pithy nor creative, I shall borrow great words from a man long, really, dead. To the last I grapple with thee. From hell's heart I stab at thee. For hate's sake I spit my last breath at thee. Melville, Ahab. Off I go to the Pequod. 22:01 hours. 170 miles as the crow flies, that was the distance to Lake Charles. It wouldn't be a straight shot for me, as I had decided to fly over Hobby Airfield again to see if the fuel truck would still be available in the event I needed it on the way back. I had 500 nautical miles before my aircraft would start dropping out of the sky, very permanently. As I buzzed the Hobby at 2,000 feet, I could see the fuel truck below just as we had left it. I could also see that one of the terminal windows had shattered and numerous undead were streaming in and out of this new opening, which spilled out onto a rooftop roughly 20 feet above the concrete taxiway below. I couldn't see any of them near the fuel truck area. However, I knew that they had no fear of heights and would walk freely off the roof if they thought they could make a meal by their efforts. Satisfied with what I saw, I headed northeast toward Lake Charles. The sun was up fully and shining right into my eyes as I leveled off at 7,000 feet. After 30 minutes, I could see the remains of the city of Beaumont in the distance. I decided to go lower and possibly find survivors. According to my chart, this was a medium-sized city. Smoke and fire swirled about and inside the taller buildings. They looked like large matchsticks of varying height, each with its own unique shape of fire and smoke. This trip could have been avoided if the satellite photography system in the compound was working properly. We lost the Louisiana Pass satellite footprint 2 weeks ago. I would have loved to have typed in the coordinates of Lake Charles and found my answer without ever having to leave. Power was off in this area. All of the red anti-collision beacons installed on the tall radio towers were out, compounding the fun. I was flying low and slow, scanning Beaumont's city streets and buildings that were not on fire. I strained my eyes best I could, but saw no survivors. The only things out walking on this nice summer day are them, those that are not us. After three passes over what I thought was the center section of the city, I was convinced that no survivors remained. At least, none that had any way of signaling. Lake Charles Airfield was roughly 50 miles east of Beaumont. At current rate of speed, I would be there in 28 minutes. This turned out to be a very long wait. I was apprehensive about meeting new survivors. I had no idea what to expect. The note in my pocket clearly says Davis family, but I still didn't know if this Davis fellow would turn out to be friend or foe. Hell, the note was dated for the 14th of last month. I had no guarantees they were even still vertical, or at least living vertical. It didn't take long before I could see the boot-shaped lake getting bigger off the nose of the aircraft. On the chart, this lake was just south and a little west from my destination. I had to find them. Having another pilot in the event anything happened to me would be useful to the others. At least having Davis around would be sort of an insurance policy. The sun was still high in the sky. It was almost 2 o'clock when I arrived in the area of the airfield. It took a little window shopping to pick it out over the clutter and smoke of the urban areas below. Lowering my nose, I slowed to 70 knots and began my descent. I could see numerous figures below, near the runway. From where I was, it appeared that there were numerous survivors. I could see their brightly colored clothing even from this distance, unlike the soiled, worn clothing of the undead. It even seemed that they had people working, as I could see someone carrying signal cones, the cones that have a flashlight attached to them and are used to signal the flight deck to a parking spot. I don't know what had caused me to see what I wanted, but I soon realized that I had been fooled. This airfield was overrun. A large section of fence was out on the eastern side of the airfield, and the undead had overwhelmed the area. Leveling my nose, I attempted a pass at the tower in the event they had made a stand inside. Nothing. Nothing but them. They were everywhere, even inside the tower. As I neared the departure end of the runway, I could see a small aircraft sitting below. The doors were open, and there were bodies strewn all around the aircraft. I lost count of how many. Several of them were gathered around the propeller section of the aircraft, as if they'd walked into it and were sliced up on the spot. I could also see numerous body parts, arms mostly, around the forward section of the aircraft. My suspicions were confirmed as I began my climb out of the area. Practically the moment I had decided that it was time to leave and go back home, I spotted them. I could see two people waving frantically from the catwalk that surrounded the airfield's main water tank tower. Waving for their lives below were a young boy and a woman. I made another pass and rocked my wings to signal that I had seen them. There was a sleeping bag and some boxes sitting on the tower with them. It seemed unlikely that they had survived after being exposed to the elements for who knows how long, trapped on the tower. I was moving too fast to be able to get a good look at them, but slow enough to know that they were alive. The tower was positioned off the airfield on the other side of the broken chain-link fence. I would have found them sooner by the masses of undead that were pawing on the pillars below if it were not for the bottom of the tower being shrouded in trees and smaller undergrowth. I could see the undead relentlessly begging upward when I flew nearly on top of the water tower. Landing at the airfield was not an option. With the break in the fence, the scores of undead gathered below the survivors would pour in and easily swarm me. They would be drawn to the noise of the engine. An even bigger problem would be taking off again without hitting one with catastrophic effect. I wanted to figure out a way to tell them I was coming back for them, but with my adrenaline rushing at the prospect of dealing with the undead, I could not. I brought the aircraft up and departed the airfield, searching for a suitable landing strip. I cruised east, flying as low as possible, looking for anywhere within 10 miles that I could set her down. According to my chart and the view from the cockpit, I was flying directly over Interstate Highway 10. I could see cars all over the highway in the eastbound lane. However, the westbound lane was relatively empty. I kept a mental note of how long and how fast I was flying so as to anticipate my hike back to the water tower. As my mental calculations kept spinning in my head, I noticed yet another post-apocalyptic odyssey on the ground. A large section of I-10 was missing, along with an adjacent overpass. There was a green military vehicle parked near an explosion crater and numerous danger signs posted around the area. I suppose that either the highway was intentionally blown in the days after the outbreak, or the bridge collapsed and chronic erosion took the rest of the highway. Either way, this was my opportunity, and I had to commit. I commenced an emergency landing on the interstate. I remember driving this very strip of highway 2 years before when I was transferred for military training, and now I would be landing an aircraft on it. It was clear. I could see some debris in the distance, but I would be well clear of it before it became an issue. I brought her down, but not without complications. I began to apply my brakes to slow my speed down the strip of road. 1, 2, then 4 of them shuffled out of the high, grassy median of the highway, not as many as I would have thought. As I pressed the brakes a little harder, I felt a jolt in the pedals, and the aircraft turned sharply to the right. I had lost one of my brakes. I had no choice but to apply opposite rudder to straighten the aircraft out and just ride it out until the aerodynamic drag stopped me. Now, the debris that I thought would not be a factor suddenly became a big one. I tapped the good brake while applying opposite rudder to straighten my yaw, each time kissing the grass on the right side of the highway. I stopped barely short of the debris that would have resulted in a likely fatal crash. The obstruction and mess blocking my roll 50 meters in the distance was nothing more than another blast hole, a green army truck, and collapsed overpass. I doubted that 2 overpasses would coincidentally collapse like that. They were likely a result of professional demolition. I barely had enough room to turn the aircraft around and get it set up for takeoff. That is, if I made it back. I shut the engine down, taking special care to keep an eye on the small numbers approaching as I readied my pack for the expedition. I reached into the back seat of the aircraft and pulled out my carbine and magazines. I stuffed the extra magazines in my pack and put the other 4 go-to mags in easily accessible pockets. My sidearm was already at my side. I placed 4 bottles of water and 2 MRE packages in the pack also. I had no idea how long they had been surviving on the tower or if they had been without water for very long. I shut the aircraft door and turned around. Shocked, startled by the snarling, decomposing face of one of the creatures. I struck it in the temple with the butt of my rifle and kicked it hard in the knee, bringing it to the ground. That one wasn't worth the bullet or the byproduct of the loud rifle report. It didn't move again as I walked away from the aircraft. I walked perpendicular to the interstate into the woods. I would shadow the road from here, safer from their ever-searching, always vigilant gaze. I could see them through the trees intermittently as I passed. They seemed confused, knowing something of interest was near, but unsure how to benefit from it. It was hot and humid, but I kept on. My soul had no choice. I finally made it to the point where the first demolitions had occurred. I hadn't noticed the undead soldier on my first flyover, as he was in my blind spot on the other side of the truck when I made the pass. It wasn't difficult to tell what happened to him. The back of his green coat was shut in the driver's side door, prohibiting movement. His coat was zipped up to his chest, and he was wearing a Kevlar helmet strapped to his chin. He was missing large chunks of flesh and muscle from his shoulder and neck. It was apparent that he had rushed out of the truck only to shut his coat in the door, inviting catastrophe. I suppose the Darwin Award had a winner for this month. No point in letting him see me, as he would only pound on the truck like a drum and invite more creatures. I needed to leave him just as he was. Part of me wanted to put him out of his misery, as he was a fellow military man. I quietly walked around to the passenger side of the large truck and had a look inside. Sitting in the seat was an M9 pistol. The window was rolled up and the door was locked on my side. I only had my rifle and pistol, and it wouldn't be a bad idea for the survivors to have a weapon for the rescue operation. I changed my mind and made the decision to kill the soldier as a trade for the pistol. I stepped down off the running board of the truck and walked to the rear. It was a transport truck with a canvas-covered wagon-type bed. I peered into the bed. I could see nothing of use in the back of the truck, just wooden crates full of God knows what. Probably explosives. That wasn't my field of expertise. I picked up a large chunk of leftover interstate and tossed it on the concrete near the creature's feet to make it look the other way as I advanced. It worked. I quickly approached the thing and shoved the muzzle of my weapon underneath the helmet, getting around the Kevlar, protecting its head. I squeezed off one round. The creature went limp and just hung there until I opened the door. I checked its pockets. Nothing of value. I took the M9 and left the scene. I didn't have much time to figure out a way to get them off the water tower. We needed to be out of here before sundown. Neutralizing the creatures was not an option. I had the advantage of a brain and firepower, but there were just too many of them. I needed another way. It seemed the only option was to run up to them and start screaming or shooting, drawing them from the tower, which was similar to the way I extracted the Grisham family. That was also too dangerous, as I did not have a working car to lead them away. More lack of planning. I had planned only to land at Lake Charles, make contact, and possibly transport survivors to Hotel 23. I didn't plan for another ridiculous rescue effort. The water tower was in view. I could see one of them on the catwalk. I tried to wave my arms and signal, but there was no response. It almost made me second-guess myself. I wondered if I had gone through this trouble only to be saving two corpses. It was then that my efforts were reaffirmed. I could see a small male figure urinating off the edge of the railing onto the corpses below. Although I could not see the corpses through the undergrowth, I knew what the boy was doing. He was mischievously aiming for their heads. I briefly chuckled to myself and got back to business. The water tower was only about 10 meters from the airport perimeter fence. The top of the fence was not barbed, and I could easily climb over it. So I jogged to a section out of view of the creatures and did just that. As soon as I hit the ground, I started running toward the hangar. I saw a row of electric-powered luggage carts plugged into a charging bank behind the hangar. I slowly moved over to them. I had no idea how long the power had been out in this area, so I didn't know if they would still operate. I unlatched one of them and pulled it out to the side of the hangar so that I could get a good look at it. I had drawn a curious corpse on the other side of the fence. It must have seen me jump over. There were no keys for the small luggage cars, I suppose to avoid foreign object debris, FOD damage to the aircraft engines in the event the keys were dropped on the taxiway. I turned the switch to the on position, sat down, and pressed the accelerator. The electric engine jolted over, but the cart did not move. I tried another. There were several, all in a row behind the building. On the third cart, I was successful. It hummed to life, and I immediately hopped on and drove toward the broken section of the fence near the water tower. I stopped on the center of the runway and got out, leaving the luggage cart on. I shouldered my rifle and began shooting at the base of the tower, taking down as many as I could before every undead eye in a 2-mile radius looked my way. I kept firing until the mass of them started pouring out of the opening in the fence, arms outstretched and wanting me. I waited until they were 50 meters distant before I got back into the cart and drove away, drawing the undead away from the tower. As I sped down the runway, I reloaded my magazine. I couldn't tell, but if I were to guess, I would say there were at least 200 to 300 of them behind me. I was at the end of the runway. I got out and started shooting at them again. They were about 300 yards away at this point. I had some time. I killed the ones near me that were already inside the airport perimeter first. Then I started selectively picking off the large crowd, aiming for the ones most distant first. That would buy me more time before they caught up to me when I made my transition back to the tower. They were now at 100 yards. There were so many flies buzzing around the mass it was sickening. I could easily hear the flies' collective buzz over their moans. I would have to say that the worst thing about them is their dried, decomposing faces, their lips locked in a permanent snarl with bony hands reaching for purchase. It was time to roll. I jumped back in the cart and circled around the mass and put the accelerator to the floor. This thing had limitations on its speed for safety. I was only going 10 or 15 miles per hour at best. As I neared the tower, I screamed for them to get ready. I couldn't tell if they heard me or not. The bulk of the creatures were almost 1,000 yards away. We had time, but I still had to take care of the dozen or so that had remained at the base of the tower. The battery in the cart was beginning to show signs of drain. I was at the break in the fence. The foliage was restricting my view, and I had no way of knowing exactly what was hiding inside. I opened fire on what I thought was ahead. I gave up on this tactic and carefully walked into the undergrowth under the tower. The ones that were left behind were probably deaf, as they were in advanced stages of decomposition. They probably didn't even hear my gunfire. Many of them had only one eye, or none at all. They were easy targets. It was not long before the base of the tower was secure. I called up to the survivors to get down as fast as they could. I heard a woman's commanding voice say, "Danny, do as the man says." Then the boy replied nervously, "Yes, Granny." The boy went first. He was about 12 years old, with brown hair and dark brown eyes with a light complexion. Then came the female. She looked to be in her late 50s or even early 60s. She had red curly hair and was slightly overweight. They were both on the ground, holding what few belongings they had, looking to me for answers. My confidence seemed to drain along with the golf cart battery after seeing so many of the creatures. I mustered up what acting ability I had, Abraham Lincoln in kindergarten, and feigned confidence, telling them to follow me. Before we left, I took a zip tie out of my pack and went over to the luggage cart. They were closer now, about 600 yards, and closing fast. I climbed into the luggage cart and put it into reverse. A loud warning beep sounded. I zip-tied the pedal down so that it would go until it hit something or the battery was completely depleted. I jumped out and rolled to avoid injury as the cart drove off, beeping loudly, in the direction of the undead mass. We headed back to the aircraft, the same way I had come in, taking special care to remain undetected as we clumsily traipsed through the foliage parallel to Interstate 10. I could hear loud moans coming from behind us from the direction of the airport. We were upwind from them. No doubt they could somehow smell us, even though I admit I never bothered to examine one closely enough to see if it even breathed. As we journeyed through the woods in the general direction of the aircraft, I handed the woman the M9 that I had stolen from the Army transport truck earlier. She told me that her name was Dean and that this was her grandson, Danny. I shook both of their hands and pulled out the yellow handwritten note that I had found hidden in the fuel truck at Hobby Airport. The woman looked at the note. Her bloodshot eyes began to tear up, and she stopped for a moment, looking into my eyes. She reached out her arms and hugged me while she cried. My first thought was that Mr. Davis was a close friend and family member of hers, and that the note had somehow surfaced painful recent memories of his untimely demise. "I know you are happy, but we have to keep moving. There are too many of those creatures around. The golf cart won't fool them for long," I told her. She insisted that she needed a minute or two to get her bearings. What could I say? If my mother ever found out I had disrespected my elder, I'd get my ass kicked. I asked the woman what had happened to Mr. Davis and his family. She replied, "Danny and I are the Davis family. I left the note at Hobby Regional last month, right before we flew here." Puzzled and feeling the ever so slight sting of sexism in the back of my mind, I humbly inquired who flew the plane. She smiled and for a brief second looked a little younger and said, "I did. I'm a certified pilot, or used to be, when being a certified pilot meant something." Holding back my look of jackassery, I scanned the area for any threat and continued talking to the woman named Dean. Danny sat on the ground in front of her feet, his small head scanning all around for threats. I felt peaceful as I spoke to this woman, almost as if she was the last grandmother left on the planet, and I wanted to hear her stories. Now wasn't the time. My main reason for stopping was to give them an emotional rest from what had just happened at the water tower. Although the woman was more than capable of handling herself, she was still an older woman, and I felt that they had needed this brief break in the action. The woman called Dean showed obvious signs of malnutrition. Loose skin hung from her arms and legs as a testament to her love for her grandson. Danny didn't look great either, but I could tell that food had been given up for his survival. With guilt and a little sorrow in my voice, I made the suggestion that we keep moving and get to the aircraft as soon as possible. It would be very difficult to find the fuel truck at Hobby if we were forced to fly at night. As we walked, I tried to keep Dean's mind off today's events by quietly asking her why she learned to fly. She was eager and happy to talk about it. As she whispered, I kept glancing past her face into the breaks in the trees that intermittently revealed the interstate. From time to time during our move to the plane, I saw them. She quietly spoke as she walked of how she was a retired pilot, formerly of the New Orleans Fire Department, and how she missed flying and helping people in need. She also mentioned her age in the conversation, saying that she had retired 10 years ago when she had turned 55. I couldn't believe that the woman had survived as long in this, keeping this young boy alive. I was truly in awe and fully respected this woman's will to survive. There were a few creatures up the interstate toward the airfield between the aircraft and our group. The moans of the dead were almost to the point of imagination at this distance. I told Dean how I had lost my left wheel brake in the landing and said that I hoped we wouldn't have to abort takeoff because there would be a nice, big, green army truck waiting for us at the end of this strip of interstate. She didn't seem to worry and never questioned where my piloting skills came from. She just seemed thankful to be alive. After arriving at the aircraft, I opened the door and almost caught myself shielding Danny's eyes from the corpse I had killed near the aircraft earlier. What was the point? The boy had probably pissed on more of the undead than I had ever seen. After inspecting the aircraft and strapping in, we started the takeoff checklist. Both Dean and I put on the internal communications headsets, and she helped me run the checklist, as she had over 200 hours in this particular model aircraft, much more than I had. The engine started with no problem. I gave the aircraft power and began my forward roll. There was no use testing the brakes. The area was clear. I kept my roll to 50 knots. A single corpse was approaching the concrete of the interstate from the grassy median separating I-10 east and west. I wasn't sure if I was going to make it. I then felt the yoke controls of the aircraft being pulled back to me. Dean's voice over the internal communication said, "We can make this climb!" I couldn't believe it. This climb was even steeper than the time John and I had to fly out of the dirt track before San Antonio was rocked off the map by nukes. It was not the engines that pushed me back into my seat. It was gravity. We had missed the corpse and taken off nearly 1,000 feet before I would have. I had to buck up and admit to myself she was better at flying this plane than I was. As we passed the truck, crater, and collapsed overpass, the airport once again came into sight. Out of pure curiosity, I asked Dean to take us over the airfield. As we flew over, I could see them huddled around the electric cart at the opposite end of the airfield. It was wedged into the fence, and I assume was still beeping, because the corpses were quite interested in it, trying to rip it apart. Maybe it was the smell, maybe the noise, maybe both. She asked where we were headed. I told her to fly us to her fuel truck. She did. Curious how she came to be on top of the water tower, I began asking some questions now that we were safely in the air. They landed at Lake Charles on the night of May 14. She didn't go into detail, but her hands started to shake on the controls as she spoke of how she had to leave the aircraft running, and both she and Danny had to run as fast as they could to the tower to avoid being eaten by them. All they had on the tower was what they could carry in one trip. I asked why she just didn't escape in the aircraft. She answered my question with another by saying, "Didn't you see all the bodies lying around the aircraft near the propeller when you flew over?" I could see that she was uncomfortable talking about it. She told of how she used her sleeping blanket to get water for the both of them. She had climbed up to the top of the tower from the catwalk on the side at day 6, one day after they had run out of their rationed potable water. Somehow, she unscrewed the plug on the top of the tower that was commonly used to test the water inside the tank. Using the blanket, she dipped it down into the tank and was able to get it submerged approximately 6 inches into the tank without dropping it in. She and Danny had lived off freshly squeezed Louisiana blanket water for nearly a month while enduring the endless moans of the dead below. She cried again when she spoke of this. Over Hobby, we were in need of fuel. We might have been able to make it back to Hotel 23 on fumes, but I didn't think it necessary to take the risk. I knew the fuel truck worked. I had used it recently, and I knew it had plenty of fuel. The sun was approaching the western horizon as we circled Hobby to take a look. There were undead on the roof adjacent to the shattered terminal window, and I did see a few of them on the ground below the roof. Some of them had rendered themselves immobile from the fall. Kinetics is a bitch. I landed the aircraft and taxied it dangerously close to the fuel truck and told Dean to stay inside. She didn't like this idea and wanted to help, but I could see in her eyes that she knew I was right. She wasn't 100% after starving, baking, and freezing for a month on that tower, which is why, despite her high flight hours, I kept my hands on or near the controls the entire time she flew. She may have been a better stick, but she was worn down to the wire. Leaving the engine running, as is my standard operating procedure for a situation like this, I made my way to the fuel truck. It wasn't long before I had the tanks full and the aircraft positioned to take off again. At the hold short line on the Hobby runway, I realized that I hadn't checked in with Hotel 23 for nearly 10 hours, nor did I have the headsets tuned to the VHF radio. Dean and I were talking on the way to Hobby, and we were out of range of Hotel 23 anyway, so I'd switched the VHF off after taking off from the interstate to avoid the static. Dean was using the co-pilot's controls to get the aircraft airborne in the same manner that she had used them to give control inputs to avoid the corpse on last takeoff. I kept my hands on the pilot controls, shadowing her. On a side note, as we were taking off and as I began to tune the radios to contact Hotel 23, I noticed a corpse hanging out of the large Boeing aircraft cockpit window that John, Will, and I had attempted to explore weeks ago. It was obviously stuck at the waist, and I could see its arms moving in a futile attempt to drop itself to the tarmac. All of the recent activity at this airfield must have excited the undead entombed in that large, multi-million-dollar sarcophagus. I keyed the microphone. H-23, this is Navy One, over. John came back. He was borderline frantic, using the proper radio discipline so as to not reveal any names or locations. He came back. Navy One, this is H-23. We have been trying to reach you for hours. It is not safe to land at H-23 at this time. I asked John what was going on. I was instantly worried that the only enemy more dangerous than the dead was attacking again. He came back and told me that there had been a recent influx of undead to the landing area and the area surrounding the back fence, and that it would not be safe to land as there were currently over 100 of them standing where I would be attempting to touch down. I asked him if there was any way he could clear it out, as I was coming back with 1 + 2 souls on board. He replied that it would be too dark to do anything in 20 minutes. I agreed. It would be suicide to go out there at night and attempt to herd them out of the way, and even then, there would be no guarantee that it would work. It would only take one of those things to hit the aircraft at 80 knots to cause terrible structural engine damage and quick death to all on board. We had to find somewhere to stay tonight. Fast. Eagle Lake Airfield was out of the question for obvious reasons. I would not be willing to take a chance and land the aircraft in an unknown field. I had to find an airfield. I began scanning my chart for any possible candidates. On the chart was a very small airstrip called Stovall, about 14 miles southwest of H-23. That would have to do. The sun would be down by the time we were there, so it was going to have to be another NVG landing. This time, I was not willing to cut the engines, as we had no guaranteed shelter to escape to if this went south on us. We had to take our chances with the engine noise. Not knowing how Dean would react, I asked Danny to reach into my bag and pull out the hard plastic green case. He did. Dean was at the controls. I began to explain to her what we had to do and that we basically had no choice in the matter. I asked her to cut the exterior collision lights and be prepared to give me control when it became too dark for her to see any detail on the ground. I pointed out the airfield we were heading for. She slightly altered heading, and we made way. I pulled the NVGs out of the case and strapped them on my head. I wanted to give my eyes plenty of time to adjust, just to make sure. I turned the intensity down so low that the goggles were acting more as a blindfold than a night vision aid. It was getting very dark outside. I asked Dean for the controls just as I adjusted the NVG intensifiers. The landscape below came alive in the familiar green color to which I had become so accustomed. I began searching for the airfield. It wasn't there. I kept searching and searching, checking the chart. I was looking for an airstrip with a tower. It took 20 minutes before I realized that we had flown over it several times. This field was abandoned and didn't have a tower. The strip was almost grown up to the point that the aircraft could nearly cut the grass with the prop as it landed. I could, however, still see the concrete and make out the strip. There was nothing in the area of this field except one lone hangar. I flew near it to see if any of the doors on it were open. It seemed secure. I brought the plane around for the landing. I had become acclimated to the depth perception problem I was having with the NVGs and made a better landing this time. I positioned the aircraft for tomorrow's takeoff, cut the engines, and kept a vigilant watch. They are sleeping right now. We landed at about 2100 hours. I contacted John and told him our coordinates. He said that he and Will would take care of them in the Land Rover tomorrow and not to worry. He laughed and told me to make sure that I turn the radio on in the morning and said that he would be up monitoring his all night. I asked how Tara was doing. John said that she was sitting right next to him and that she said she misses me. 9 June. 0218 hours. I see movement in the distance at the outer perimeter of the airfield. Not sure what it is. The cabin doors are locked, and I am sleepy, but refuse to nod off. Dean is awake. I am not telling her what I see. 0354 hours. The movement in the distance turned out to be a family of deer. I could tell they were living creatures by the mirror-like reflection of their eyes caused by the effects of night vision. The undead do not share this comforting quality. 0622 hours. The sun is up and the radios are on. I have already spoken to John, and he will be giving me the go-ahead within the next hour. There is no movement in this area, and the family of deer has moved out. Dean and Danny have already eaten much of the food that I have brought. Can't say that I blame them. 0740 hours. Call made. John says it's clear. We're taking off shortly. 11 June. 0940 hours. We arrived at Hotel 23 on the morning of the 9th without incident. Jan stayed in touch via the VHF radios and relayed John and Will's position to us in the air as they herded the undead mob safely away from our landing spot. Before we touched down at H23, I told Dean not to expect much of our shelter and that there would now only be 9 of us, including Annabelle. Danny was wearing a headset in the back seat. It was too big for him, and I found it funny how it kept slipping off as he asked the question,
"Who is Annabelle?"
I told Danny that we had a puppy at Hotel 23, and that her name is Annabelle, and she loves little boys. Danny began to tear up in happiness at the prospect of touching something truly good again, and not having to look at the ugly people, as he had been calling them. I saved Laura as a surprise for him. I can't imagine the joy in his heart when he saw another child to play with, even though she was a girl. Although it only comes to me once in a great many years, a flash of memory, a familiar smell from an old cedar chest of keepsakes, I still remember what it was like being 12. It was like being 12. Crude. 14 June. 2247 hours. We had a meeting today. All 9 of us attended, although Laura, Danny, and Annabelle did not pay attention. They were quietly playing in the corner as we talked. Dean is looking much better. I caught her up on the recent events at Hotel 23 regarding the bandits and basically gave her a rundown on everyone here and how we came to find each other. She had a few stories of survival herself regarding the months leading up to her imprisonment at the Tower of Charles. She spoke of how she and little Danny had been in New Orleans and had heard the warning that the Big Easy would be a target and how they had taken off in her aircraft for the nearest safe zone. She never found it. They had spent months bouncing from airport to airport, scavenging food, water, and fuel, until their luck finally ran out. Dean has become the resident grandmother around here, taking care of the kids and offering advice. She even approached me yesterday in private to tell me that she could see that Tara was fond of me. I had known this for a little while, but have been too preoccupied with staying alive to do anything about it. She asked me what the purpose of survival was if I had no one to love and be loved by. I didn't really answer that. I was in no mood for emotion. We were still in some serious trouble, and I felt like I have no time for love or romance. I asked her if she had run across any survivors in her airport hopping campaign. She told another grisly tale, in which she and Danny attempted to rescue two survivors signaling for them from a field below. They were being flanked by hundreds of undead that they could not see over an adjacent hill. Dean had tried to warn them by flying over the area where the dead were advancing. However, it was too late. By the time they realized what was going on, the dead had topped the hill. The sheer number of them picked them clean like African driver ants. Dean had felt guilty about that incident, and often wondered if they were in that field solely to signal her and Danny. I tried to comfort her by saying that they were probably already there, and that she had just flown over at the right time. Odds are, she probably did draw them out into the open to signal her, but what would be the point in presenting that gruesome thought? I have gotten into a pretty good routine of exercise lately. The undead numbers have greatly declined around the complex since the Raider attack. I have installed a pull-up bar in the control room. I constructed it out of scrap, using twine to secure it to the overhead beams. John has been monitoring the radios and has had no sign of encrypted comms, or any chatter for that matter. Dean seems to think that we could be safe here as long as we keep aware of our surroundings. I informed her that there is more than one way in and out of the complex. I will be giving her a full tour of Hotel 23 in the coming days. She is no novice with firearms, and I feel that she could handle herself if need be. She is a tough old bird, a product of old-fashioned upbringing. She lost her husband to natural causes years before the undead walked. She is no stranger to death, just a stranger to death walking. 17 June. 2106 hours. GPS is gone. I'm sure the satellites are still up there, but without ground station intervention to regularly recalibrate them, they cannot transmit properly, and I cannot get a receiver lock. The internal DVD GPS navigation system in the Land Rover is useless. Because of the loss of GPS, I was eager to test the sat phones. They worked fine. John and I went topside with them, and I dialed the number imprinted on a barcode on the side of the phone John was holding. It rang through, and John did the same with the phone I was carrying. Although an excellent means of communication, they could not be considered reliable. The same goes for any communication that depends on complex third-party mechanisms. I have been sleeping in the environmental control room, as I have given up my living quarters to Dean and Danny. It is a little cooler in my new quarters. There are plenty of other compartments to choose from. I just like being somewhat close to everyone else. There is even a rather large compartment with lockers and folding cots. I am sure they are probably for civilian survivors that would encounter this place during and after a nuclear exchange. I just wish I had something useful and positive to accomplish, besides staying alive. I pulled my wallet out of my personal belongings today and looked at my Armed Forces identification card. The man depicted on that card didn't look like me. Sure, it was my face, name, and social security number. However, the eyes, they were different. The eyes in the photo didn't have the same gaze as those of the man I see in the mirror now. I will keep it. Keep it as a memento of what I once was, a cog in the wheel of something greater. It has been 6 months to the day since the first time I saw one of them eye to eye. They still have the same chilling effect. I am certain they always will. 20 June. 2309 hours. It is raining very hard right now. The weather is playing hell with the closed-circuit TV, causing static and loss of V-hold. The undead in this area are pretty spread out, but I can still make them out during an intense lightning flash. Still no joy on the radios. There is no one out there, or at least no one in our range. I have been flipping through the watchman's diary to pass the time during the storm. I sort of forgot about it due to the current events at Hotel 23. I had gone to my old quarters last night to pick up the last of my personal effects when it resurfaced. Dean had packed my cardboard box for me and told me how nice I was for giving up my space for her and Danny. She told me that she had found my personal diary but wouldn't dare take a peek. I explained to her that it wasn't mine and that it belonged to a person who was formerly posted here. I told her that I was keeping it for him. She understood and handed it to me, trying to figure out whether she had sent something wrong. I gave her a reassuring smile as I took the diary out of her hand, threw it into the box, and started walking to my new quarters in the environmental control room. It wasn't until tonight that I reopened Captain Baker's personal log. January 10 was dog-eared, as I had remembered reading it before. I turned the page and began reading January 11. January 11. As suspected, according to the recently received message traffic, we will not be permitted to leave for quite some time. This facility will be more than adequate for extended habitability, but staying here underground really takes a mental toll on you. Unlike myself, he is married and I am not sure how long he will remain sane if this order to stay underground continues. He is constantly daydreaming and writing letters to his wife, letters that he cannot even mail until we are cleared topside by high command. I have received official communications involving the situation in Asia. It is above the classification of this log and will not be included. I know we will be secure down here no matter what, and that is what is important to U.S. strategic deterrence. The only other thing on this page was a freehand doodle of a missile flying through the air over what appears to be the United States. 23 June. 21:30 hours. I have a splitting headache. Normally, I force myself to drink enough water to remain hydrated, but today, I just didn't get around to it. I have a dehydration headache, and no matter how much water I drink at this point, it won't matter. It will just have to run its course. On the morning of the 21st, John, Will, and I went out scouting. Instead of heading in the direction of the crucifixes, we went westerly, toward the small town of Hallettsville. We didn't take the Land Rover as we wanted to remain quiet and avoid detection. For all we knew, there were still bandits in the area. We walked through fields and undeveloped farmland. It had been over 6 months since anyone was alive to maintain the land, so it wasn't a surprise when we stumbled upon them. We had jumped yet another fence into derelict farmland when we observed the sentinel symbols of United States greed and power. There was a large refinery field, and the skeletal hulks of the large ground pumps were just sitting there, unmoving. Grass was overgrown all around them, and it was obvious that they had been dead for months. I suppose the bright side to the living population being annihilated is the fact that our oil reserves should last thousands of years longer. Of course, the downside is the fact that no one is alive who knows the art of refining the crude oil, hence making it as useless as a Hadron Collider. John and I have long since discussed the need for technical manuals on everything from farming to medicine to things like refining crude. The information we require would be in countless abandoned libraries throughout the United States. However, getting to the information and getting it back to Hotel 23 could prove most fatal. Passing the second large oil pump, I made yet another macabre discovery. I suppose when the world ended back in January, the pumps were still running for a while. It looks like one of those bastards was crushed by the pendulum arm of the pump and its lower torso was caught in the machinery. I couldn't tell if it was still reanimated. I gave it no mind as I walked past. Obviously, birds had done their thing to this rotting monstrosity. William had to force himself to look away from the creature as we passed. We kept on, seeing no signs of life. Our tactic was avoidance, as we had no suppressors or silent weapons to use. We would open fire only if our lives were in danger. We dodged 3 walking dead in the field before returning home. They were quite mobile, but still too slow to keep up. They would follow. However, I doubt they could ever make it over the many fences that separate our compound from this oil field. John and I have had further discussions about the need to gather some reference books, so we will be planning and executing this operation in the days to come. Semper Fi. 26 June. 18:53 hours. During our normal monitoring of the parking lot area of the compound, we noticed movement on the road beyond it. It looked much like an 8-wheeled USMC light armor reconnaissance vehicle. There was only one. It was moving at a high rate of speed, headed northeast relative to the compound. I wish I could have recorded the image so that I could maybe enhance it and catch a better glimpse of the gunner. My only conclusion would be that this is a scout and he, she, was sent as a forward observer only to return and report the situation to the person in charge. I could be totally wrong, and this could just be a rogue unit, running and gunning in the lav across the country. I don't know much about these vehicles, and I have only seen one once. They are amphibious and capable of taking some serious small arms fire. This could be one of the last remnants of the Marine Corps in this area. Who knows if they are still loyal to the cause? If I were, I would not be writing this. Dean and I took the children topside to play a few hours after the lab sighting. I told her of my plan to take John into an urban outskirt area for the purpose of retrieving some vital technical manuals. She seemed to think it a good idea. However, she told me that she had already known my plan. Tara had told her about it after talking to John. Tara seemed to think it was a crazy plan. She hadn't mentioned her feelings about me, but it seems that she is able to talk to Dean about anything. Dean just warned me that she might be upset that I choose to leave the safety of the compound for something as trivial as books. After seeing the military vehicle go by earlier today, I am not certain what to do. I know we need specific medical manuals, as we have two children and an older lady at the compound. I am no doctor. Jan is the closest thing we have. 29 June. 19:13 hours. It all began last night. It had started as simple radio garble. That night, it intensified. I could hear a frantic human voice drowned out by automatic weapons fire. Only bits and pieces were discernible. It stopped at nightfall. During John's watch that night, it began again. It was 2300 hours. The weapons fire had lessened to a frequency and sound that reminded me of microwave popcorn in the waning phase of popping. The voice identified himself as Lance Corporal Ramirez of the 1st Battalion, 23rd Marines. He and his crew were broke dick and trapped inside their ride. He claimed to have six souls on board. They had a mechanical malfunction and were stranded in a sea of undead. There was screaming in the background, and I couldn't tell if someone had been injured or was just delirious. These Marines were most likely the same unit sighted yesterday speeding past our compound. John called me into the control room at this point, and I made the decision to initiate communications with the Marines. I keyed the microphone and said in a calm, cool voice, "To the Marine unit transmitting a distress call, transmit your latitude and longitude. Over." After a few seconds of static, we received a reply.
"Unidentified station! We are in need of assistance and extraction! Please repeat your transmission! Over!"
I then repeated my request four times before the radio operator finally came back with the latitude and longitude of their position.
"Station calling! Our position is believed to be North 2952, West 09702. Your transmissions are weak and nearly unreadable. 2x5. We are out of crew-served weapon rounds and have closed the hatch on our vehicle. Situation is dire. Please render assistance."
I really had no choice. I couldn't leave those Marines to die there. Those things couldn't get into the lav, but the Marines couldn't get out, either. I marked the position on the map, and John, William, and I began our hasty preparation. We left as soon as we could that night, to take advantage of the cover of darkness. I took one of the handheld shortwave HF radios, the M16 with the M203 launcher, my Glock, and NVGs. I pointed out where we were going on the map, and William suggested that we take one of the Geiger counters. I agreed. Before leaving, I asked John to help me cut the rank off of my shoulders. I couldn't risk these men finding out that I am, or was, military. We also grabbed several pillowcases in the event we had to bring them back here. If I could land a plane at night with NVGs, I could definitely drive the Land Rover. The only problem that I found was the need to stick to the paved roads to avoid getting stuck. This vehicle was made for off-road use, but unlike the lab the Marines were trapped inside, it was not designed, if stuck, to repel hundreds of dead fists and bloody stumps. We were out the door by 0:30 hours, and headed northwest to the rendezvous point. As I walked out of the compound, I reached over to my left shoulder and pulled off the Velcro American flag that I had worn on my uniform since the start of this. Once again, I couldn't risk being discovered and forced back to active duty for a futile cause, or worse, sent to the brig. I made my bed when I decided to leave my unit and survive. I believe I'm the last one left. There was no way to defeat our foe. We had to wait them out. According to the chart, we had just over 30 miles of dangerous territory to cover. Judging by the information they had given me, they were 8 miles west of LaGrange, Texas. Once again, the map indicated this was a very small town. The Marines were less than a mile southwest of the Colorado River. The area they were in was technically deep inside the radiation zone and was also the closest I had been to a fallout area since rescuing the Grishams. I was apprehensive about this as I remembered transmissions from the Louisiana congressman last March. We could be going into the lion's mouth. We had lost the broadcast from Louisiana, and I had often wondered what had happened there. Did the scouts that the congressman dispatched only draw a legion of radiated undead to their position? We ran into no trouble until we arrived at I-10. Of course, the interstate was a war zone, and tall grass had grown up between the east and westbound lanes. For all we knew, there could have been an army of them behind the grass wall. All this projected a very surreal feeling, and made me realize how quickly things fall apart with no human intervention. Approaching the on-ramp that would take us to 71 North, we came upon a four-car pileup. There was no way to go around the wreckage, as a tall concrete wall had put the wreckage between a rock and a hard place. We were going to have to pull one of the cars out of the way with the Land Rover. We had removed the bulbs from the tail brake lights a couple of weeks ago. With the headlights turned off, we would show no lights no matter how much I pressed the brakes. We also took the bulbs out of the blinker lights just in case one of us accidentally bumped the turn signal. Of course, there was always human error. John and William got out of the vehicle to attach the chain to one of the wrecked cars. I could see through my NVGs that William was signaling me to back up. With the grainy green resolution, I couldn't see beyond John and William into the darkness of the on-ramp behind them. I shifted the transmission into reverse. Instantly, the light from the rear and side-view mirrors induced whiteout in my goggles. In all our attention to detail, we had overlooked the bulb that illuminates when you put the vehicle in reverse. The light shone like a phoenix. Yanking the goggles off my head, I checked the mirrors again. Something was moving behind my friends. I backed into position, quickly put the vehicle in neutral, and put the parking brake on. I called out to John and William to drop the chain and get back in the vehicle. I was the only one who could see in the dark, so it was only logical that I be the one to face whatever it was that was moving in reaction to our light. While fumbling with the NVGs to get them back on, I could hear John and Will drop the chain. I heard their smacking footsteps and the sound of something more distant. I stepped out of the vehicle and lightly shut the door, causing it to barely latch, hoping for the familiar reflection of the living eyes of an animal through the NVGs. I stepped forward. Rounding the back of one of the wrecked vehicles was the corpse of some sort of builder or contractor. His leather tool belt still held a hammer in place. All the other tools must have fallen out. He wasn't badly decomposed. He could not see me, and could not negotiate a path through the wreckage, so he just stood there, trying to sense where I was. The former builder's hair wasn't long. He didn't have much facial hair. It was a common myth that when people die, their hair and nails continue to grow. This was not true. Upon death, nothing grows. Unless you count the undead hunger. I wasn't sure, but judging by the tool belt, the short hair, and the apparent clean shave, this man had been one of the first to go 6 months ago. Aside from a large chunk of meat missing from his shoulder, he was very well preserved. As I got a closer look, I noticed some skin and hair stuck to the claw of his hammer. He likely had killed the creature that bit him with the tool now holstered on his belt. Since the creature was standing still and posed no immediate threat, I went back to the vehicle and grabbed the Geiger. I had spent some time reading the directions, as my recent new quarters was the environmental and equipment room of Hotel 23. I had learned all about the restrictions for the MCU-2P gas mask, as well as the limitations of the chemical, biological, and radiological protective gear. I had even devoted a whole night to Geiger counter operations. I turned the Geiger on and placed the earbud in my ear. After giving it sufficient warm-up time, I used it on John. The Geiger indicated a normal rad level. The static clicking sound in my ear was random. As I neared the vehicle wreckage, the static picked up intensity. I was sure these vehicles had absorbed some radiation, being inside the zone. They were still within safe exposure levels, as long as I didn't sit in them for a prolonged period. I reached over the wrecked hood of one of the cars to get a reading from the corpse. The sound in my ear sounded like that of an old dial-up modem. This corpse was hot, far beyond safe levels. Looking down at the meter, I saw that it read 400R. I definitely did not want a hug from this one. As I pulled my hand back over the hood, the corpse must have caught the smell as it walked violently forward into the car, shaking it on its shocks. It was jerking erratically, unlike any corpse that I have seen so far. It moved laterally to the car, and then I caught a glimpse of its feet. The creature's boots were nearly worn away. It had likely been walking on them for months without pause. The soles were gone, and its maimed feet were visible under nothing but strips of leather and dangling bootlaces wrapped around its ankle. The corpse was visibly excited, possibly by my presence. It moved back and forth like one of those toy robots. It would bump into a section of wreckage and turn and try another spot. If it kept doing this, eventually it would make it around the wreckage. I couldn't afford contact with this creature, as it was soaked with radiation. Picking up the chain, I kept a close eye on the robot corpse. I attached the chain around the axle of the vehicle I intended to move. I silently moved back to the Land Rover and got in. I told John and Will that we had a hot one outside. I planned to pull the car out of the way, unhook the chain, and leave without dealing with the corpse. I put the vehicle in gear and slowly pulled forward. I felt the tension on the chain and heard it pop taut. I gave it some more gas and felt the car give way. I kept going for at least 50 yards before getting out and executing my plan. Once out, I trained my eyes on the place where the car used to be. The thing was approaching. It was trying to run, but obviously lacked the coordination to do so. It fell, got back up, and kept coming. It had no idea where it was going, but as luck would have it, the thing was headed right for the Land Rover. I immediately unhooked the chain, opened the back door, and tossed it in without looking. I heard William curse as the 50-pound chain hit his feet. Just as I got back into the vehicle and locked the doors, I heard the corpse bounce off the back window. I floored the Land Rover and turned it around, speeding through the hole I had just made in the wreckage. In my rear-view mirror, I could see the corpse attempting to give chase as it clumsily half-jogged behind, homing in on the sound of the vehicle. I can't lie to myself. I thought for a brief second about canceling this mission and heading home. What could the three of us do against an army of poisoned dead? We were closer now. Will attempted to make contact via the radio. He keyed the microphone and called out. We heard nothing, but this radio set wasn't as powerful as the one at Hotel 23. They could still be alive. After imagining what it would be like to be them, I pushed the thought of mission abort out of my mind. Only minutes after Will first tried the radio, they came back. Again, the Lance Corporal identified himself as well as his unit. I pulled the vehicle over and grabbed the radio from Will. I asked the Corporal if he had an update to his coordinates and if he had any small arms inside the lav. He replied that they were still at the previous position and they were all armed and had small arms ammunition. However, there was no way to fire outside the vehicle accurately without the top hatch open. He also commented that they were out of ammo for the crew-served weapon, and that was the reason they had to close the hatch. I asked how many undead were at his position. After a pause, it seemed he didn't want to tell me. He informed me that he was a Marine and couldn't count that high. I asked him, "Hundreds, Corporal?" He replied, "Yes, sir." Both John and William cursed loudly and shook their heads in apprehension of what was about to go down. It was about to get real. We only needed I-10 for 2 miles. We exited north on 71 and sped toward the Marines. The only tactic we could possibly use is the one that I had executed with the Grishams and one that I had seen performed by the Raiders. I had to try to herd them away from the broken-down vehicle. Maintaining radio contact, I tried to make some small talk to keep their minds off of the immediate surroundings. The corporal informed me that they had left the highway for the river because the sheer number of dead on the highway was overpowering them. Their vehicle experienced mechanical failure near the river. They were going to attempt to cross the river and escape the undead using the amphibious capability of the lav. Initially, it wasn't the corporal's beacon light that enabled me to find them. It was the overwhelming moans of the dead. I told the men that I would attempt to lead the mass of them away with the noise of our vehicle and the horn. We established a rally point, and I told the Marines to escape the lav and evade to Highway 71 at the same spot they initially left the highway. They agreed. After saying a little prayer in my head, I asked John and Will if they were ready. Giving them no time to reply, I hit the gas and sped toward the moat of undead that surrounded the stranded Marines. The ground was littered with corpses, victims of the lab's crew-served weapon barrage. I was maybe 100 meters from the moat when I rolled down my window and opened fire. John and Will were on reloading duty. The flash suppressor was helping keep my goggles relevant, but it was almost more advantageous to just use the muzzle flash without the gogs to see my targets as I was firing very rapidly at the dead. I must have killed 20 of them before I had to relocate the vehicle another 100 yards down track. Will handed me a fresh magazine, and I popped out the empty, handed it to John, and quickly slapped another in the receiver. The dead were advancing quickly, as they were very attracted to my rifle muzzle flash and loud report. Like the undead builder we had avoided earlier, many of these corpses were coming at us in jerky, erratic movements. The way they approached was reminiscent of a line of police searching for a body. Ironically, the dead bodies were now searching for me. I kept shooting them, kept moving the vehicle. John and Will kept reloading. After moving the vehicle for the fourth time and opening fire again, I could see movement on top of the lav. I stopped firing for a moment to allow my eyes to adjust. The Marines were taking their opportunity for escape. Exactly as planned, they were moving as a squad toward the pickup point. I emptied my 6th magazine on the mob and then handed the very hot weapon to Will. I honked my horn and led the dead just a little farther away from the Marines before speeding back for the pickup. The 6 Marines were in a defensive posture, weapons aimed outward into the darkness. They were in uniform, including flak jackets and Kevlar helmets. I rolled down the window and told them to get in. Out of courtesy, I closed my eyes and turned on the dome light so they could see us.